Welcome to Fantastic Females, our adventure to finding the mythical island of freedom together. I'm Kalyani.
And I'm Rupali. We are your next door finance experts sharing our experiences in the world of money and energetics. So welcome back to Fantastic Females. Today we are going to cover a very interesting topic, something that's really changed the world as we know it. We are going to be talking about the Great Financial Crisis.
The GFC, as it's called now, keeps coming back in our psyche, especially recently as we are hearing a lot about a crash or a recession, at least the expectation of one. And this is from people remembering their suffering from 2008, having gone through a financial crisis. They want to try and avoid it. And a lot of what's happening in our current situation is being compared to what happened back in 2008. So we're going to tell you what happened exactly and how it compares to today's reality.
Yes. The reason why this is so important is because it's really changed the way things happen today. An example, like in the oil analogy I can think of, is the way 9/11 changed the way we fly. It increased security checks. It increased a whole lot of steps in the process of traveling. Similarly, the global financial crisis, which took place in 2008-2009, changed the way financial institutions operate. It changed requirements from the reserve banks, the regulators. It changed rules in terms of how today, if you and I go and get a mortgage or any sort of credit, it's changed all of that.
Exactly. And it's quite personal for all of us in different ways, right, Rupali? I'm giving away my age with this, but I graduated around the time that this happened. So actually in 2010 is when I graduated, and I finished my university in the UK, which was experiencing a delayed effect, especially in terms of employment. And I remember finding it really hard to get any traction with employers at the time, and the consistent repetition of why that's happening was because of the 2008 crash. There were people that I knew personally who were Oxford graduates working as plumbers, carpenters. Not to say that there's anything wrong with these jobs, but there was a widespread difficulty in finding employment at that point. So it is pretty personal for me in that sense.
I had actually quite a different experience where I was thinking about whether to study, whether to start working. My degree had also ended then. And so I had qualified, but it was my final year actually. And I was trying to decide, and a friend of mine said, here you go, here's an email address, send your CV. And that's what I did. And I received a phone call from someone who was very excited to meet me after they had already shortlisted all their candidates and gone through the entire process. But she said she just had to meet me. So it was interesting because I didn't really feel it on the ground. I heard about it. I heard about all the noise that it was causing. The banks in South Africa weren't as impacted at the time. And so maybe that's what kind of I saw, where, you know, there was plenty of liquidity. The Reserve Bank in South Africa is pretty strict. So I think it was very controlled at that point. But the banks were hit a couple of years later. And so I had already been employed, and we were losing some of the benefits we had as new fresh grads a couple of years later. So that's when I felt it.
Yeah, let's understand what really happened.
Yeah, let's go into the timelines, I think, because even now when I think of it, like, it's all about 2008, 2009. So maybe we can just kind of talk about what started it and how it kind of went.
Yeah, and this can get very technical very fast. So let's consider it a little bit like a story. Hopefully this makes it easier for all our listeners to follow. The main characters that we're considering are: there's a borrower, there's a bank, there's an ultimate lender, which is typically a large corporation lending to the bank as well, we'll explain how this plays out.
So how it all kind of started is through cheap lending, right? Interest rates were really low. Liquidity was flush. You go anywhere you look, you were getting loans. Banks were really giving easy financing. And so basically there was a lot of money in the system.
Yes, I read somewhere that the mortgage rates, the house loan interest rates were as low as 1%. And for those 3 years before all of this happened, these interest rates were below the inflation rate as well, which was at about 2.5% at the time. So this is quite significant. If people see that housing loans are that cheap, then new people want to enter the real estate market, or as an investor, you want to accumulate more real estate since it's so cheap to get, since it's so cheap to fund it.
Yeah. And so what happened is, you know, there were liquidity was flush. Banks were handing out loans and money just like that with very minimal checks. And there was that cycle had already started where people were borrowing, people that weren't used to borrowing money were borrowing, people that banks were handing out money. And so that caused like housing prices to increase, because if everyone is able to finance their house that they would like to buy, then there are more investors in the system than they are, then there's a supply. And so again, the demand supply dynamic comes in here, where the demand is high. Supply is, I mean, while supply can catch up in real estate, it's not overnight, where you can't just switch on a factory and start printing houses. Well, today I suppose you can, but in those years you couldn't. And so prices were increasing.
Yeah, so on the outside, it looked like the sector was doing really well. And people thought that real estate was booming because the prices were going up, demand was super high, and lending was easy to access. But let's try and understand how the banks were operating. How they were able to access these extra funds is quite interesting. So what they were doing was they were acting more like a middleman between the borrower and a large corporation that we've mentioned previously as the ultimate lender. This ultimate lender is a pure investing company. They don't want to be dealing with the borrowers. They just simply want to make more money. And since they had this extra cash to park, they were dealing through the banks, and they were lending to the banks, which were then lending the same funds over to borrowers, right?
Yeah, exactly. So so what banks were doing is they were able to finance easily because firstly, the regulators weren't that strict. So you didn't have to hold that much capital to be able to loaning out money like that. Secondly, as they started loaning more and more money out, handing out more mortgages, there was a new security or new vehicle that was created, which is a mortgage-backed security, which essentially is a pool of mortgages. Like it's like a loan, it's like a bond, where the underlying asset is the loan itself. And so a third person, which is the ultimate investor, as Kalyani mentioned, comes in. They give money to the bank for taking on the risk, and they then get paid. They're hoping to get paid a premium through the interest rates that the ultimate borrower is paying. And that's how the bank then becomes a middleman.
I would like to go into a little bit of detail about the mortgage securities that Rupali mentioned. What that basically means is, for the banks to be able to borrow money from these ultimate lenders, it's not just a contract of trust, right? There has to be an exchange. So what the banks did as a product that they wanted to sell in exchange for this cash that they were getting was they were pooling a variety of mortgages, and they were calling these mortgage-backed securities. And these mortgages were also rated in a very clever way. What they were doing was that they were mixing mortgages that had good ratings, decent ratings, and that was actually safe, with some really poorly rated mortgages. So the appearance of this product, the full basket of mortgages together, was that it was a safe security for the ultimate lenders to invest in, whereas that wasn't the case. And there are a lot of controversies within this, where there was some fudging around the ratings, there was corruption around that as well. We don't want to go into all of that, but there was already defaults happening from individual borrowers because they were not vetted properly, they were not checked properly. And then that led to banks defaulting on their payments to these ultimate lenders who did not know what they had actually invested in, the quality of what they had actually invested in, right? Right.
Yeah, it was like a black box where they had zero visibility. They had the guarantee of the bank. They had different slabs that were given that, oh, this is the higher rated one, this is the lower rated one that you could invest in. And for the higher rated one, you earn less money. For the lower rated one, you take more risk, you get paid more money. And so they've selected this based on these slabs without knowing what's actually within these securities, which sounds a bit counterintuitive for these big investors. It sounds a little like obvious that you shouldn't be doing stuff like that, but it wasn't. And people kind of just got into the cycle, and then greed kind of played out there, where more people saw this happening, more people saw people becoming millionaires, billionaires. And so it kind of really snowballed from there.
Yeah, so to unpack this a little further, when interest rates are so low, the banks almost have to get volume in to be able to earn a substantial amount, right? And especially if they need to share these earnings with the ultimate lender who's actually investing these funds, then they need to bring in more volume. It's a simple mathematics. When the price of the product that you're selling is low, then you need to sell a lot of it. So there was a bit of that psyche. And since cash was pretty easy for them to access through these large lenders, they didn't really care about doing the usual due diligence checks that they would on the borrowers, on the retail borrowers. So it was a win-win scenario for all three parties until things changed. Yes.
Yeah, until it wasn't. It snowballed. We mentioned previously that when in markets, ups and downs, both are required, balance is good. In this case, it was too much of a good thing, where there was money everywhere. Everyone was making money, which is good in terms of abundance and lack mindset, and it comes through. But the way it was all being done was, it was a bubble was caused as a result of it, and eventually the borrower was no longer able to pay off these loans that they had taken, because they were never at that credit quality that would have been able to afford these loans and mortgages. So because the checks were not as strict and stringent, money was just being given out. And that's why the name subprime mortgage, because it wasn't of a good quality. We all hear subprime crisis linked to the GFC, and that's what it means.
Yeah, credit bubble as well, real estate bubble, all of that, it has been just explained by Rupali. So in September 2007, as a result of this snowballing effect, the avalanche or the downward spiral, Lehman Brothers, one such bank that was doing all of this that we've just mentioned, totally collapsed. We'll go into a little bit of detail about what happened after, but basically people started losing confidence in the banking system and started withdrawing their cash. But banks don't sit on our cash, so all the cash was parked in such securities that could not be liquidated, that could not be sold. And that then led to further fear and anxiety and eventually the crash.
Yeah, I think this really summarizes it. As we said, it's more complex than this. There's a lot more that went on. There's a lot more important detail that, you know, if you really want to understand exactly what happened, you should kind of read up on and learn about. But this was just us trying to cover this in a very summarized way, so it makes sense to someone who knows nothing about banking and finance to be able to bring it back to where we are today in the markets and compare and draw a parallel, because a lot of people are comparing today and, you know, these predictions of a recession where people are saying, oh, 2008, 2009. But we are here to also highlight the differences between the two. That's very important in terms of what the drivers are, because that's when you know where to play, where to invest, where to stay out of today versus then.
Yeah, and before we get into any technical differences, Rupali, one thing that I found pretty interesting myself was 2008 crash was seen as nearly the first crash after globalization had touched all parts of the world. And now they're saying that what's happening around us now is pretty much the first time a recession's taking place in the age of social media. And both have had different impact on the psyche and actual kind of financials of the economy. So in 2008 and 9 was the first time that we noticed that the Bank of Iceland, for example, was the tip of the iceberg or the triggering point in terms of local banks had defaulted on their payments to the Central Bank of Iceland. And that was one of the first kind of red flags, and the economy of Iceland collapsed as a result. And that then had a massive domino effect on the global economy, which wasn't previously seen. Something that would happen in a small country in one corner of the world would stay pretty limited to that side of the world, which was no longer the case. And with what we're seeing now in 2022, in the age of social media, is just the sheer amount of discussion around this, and that then really drives the narrative, right? So I thought that was an interesting thing to bring up before we go into more technical differences.
Yeah, definitely. I agree. I think that really fuels it because they are suddenly people giving investment advice on WhatsApp. They are suddenly, all these chats that are taking place and people are having the fear of missing out. They're fueling each other. There's greed again playing out in terms of watching, what happened in crypto, watching people become billionaires and you suddenly want to go all in without knowing what you're and going into is similar to what happened back then. But today what's different is, the drivers are completely different. I mean, that in those days it was the banks, it was the system, it was real estate, it was cheap lending. And that's kind of what then spiraled and impacted the whole world. Whereas today, COVID was the trigger. Until 2009, 19, the market was ticking along, doing well, low interest rates, cheap funding. People still had the recent memory of the GFC, especially, our generation. You still have that in your mind, so you're playing it safe, but markets are doing all right, you're doing well. So markets were ticking along until COVID came, and overnight, suddenly markets dropped, there was a crash. And that was global, right? We saw that there were no people in Times Square. There were no people in these major, spots in the world. And so it was overnight,
Totally.
it was all over the world. It was not focused in certain areas or anything like that. And then thereafter, the reserve banks came in to support the economy because they were worried that it will not be able to come back. And so cheap lending, interest rates dropped to support that. So that you and I can borrow money for cheaper, so that we are not scared that there's a scarcity of money when we are spending, when we are living, when corporates are doing things, growing. Because if corporates are impacted, employment is impacted. So, so basically, that's what drove it. And so, if you compare, the trough in 2009 to when it kind of recovered, it was late 2000 or April 2009, where it was March actually, March 2009, where it was the trough, so the low at the crisis, and recovery was around, 2012 end. And it took that many years to get back to where markets were in 2007 before all of this happened. And so that's very important in terms of how it played out today, whereas where there was a sudden crash, and then we all know what happened in 2020, 2021 in terms of markets shot up, and then now again we're back on the downward because interest rates are high again, it's expensive, things, there's uncertainty. I think the big difference today is that happened in a systematic way, whereas today, and it was through the system, and people did not predict a recession, whereas today, this is the most talked about recession, right?
Yeah,
Everyone, literally everyone knows the word recession.
if anything, we have the converse problem, right? There's almost too much chat of recession,
Yes.
and there's also an opinion that says that the worst is actually behind us already, that the recession's happened already. Stock market has definitely been anticipating, and there's a big factor of stock market at least having priced in the recession already. What that means is that it's already played out the anxiety and the fear, so it's reacted to it already before it even happens, so to say. So that's quite interesting. And you mentioned interest rates. We started our conversation or our recap about the GFC with the point of interest rates being really low. And at this point, maybe the next topic after recession is the interest rate hikes, which is the kind of buzz phrase for 2022. The Fed has gone through, as we know, 8 to 9 interest rate updates. And that means that that shows us that they knew what they were trying to avoid, which is a similar situation back in 2008. So in fact, it's a very different problem that we're dealing with now, right? Borrowing is not cheap. And that means that there are no cheap loans being given out. So the drivers are totally different. And I think this recession is more correction than a recession, in my personal opinion, which is a reaction to the Reserve Bank's policies in during COVID time, which were short term but necessary for the time. And the economy just needs to adjust now.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, another big difference is where we highlighted that people that were taking these loans were not well off in terms of their credit quality, in terms of their credit ratings. Today, the consumer is much more cash rich. You and I, people on the ground, corporates are well off. I mean, you obviously have those that are not. You have companies that are poor. You have companies that have not managed, been managed well. But corporates and consumers are well off today. Liquidity levels, which means how much cash flow and money a company or an individual has, we're back to the levels of 2019. So now we've offset all the levels that we've kind of the up and the down post-COVID. So we're back there, which is not a bad space to be. And interest rates are high, so you're not getting cheap lending. And so it's a very different situation today.
Yes. Also, in terms of policies, you know, we've seen so many changes. When you mentioned that this was one of those 9/11 type events for banking industry, banking and real estate, I would imagine. So in our reality in the region, we've seen that all payments towards real estate properties are only done through escrow accounts, which wasn't the case before, which means that there is more due diligence done on the side of the investor as well as the real estate developer. Banks, of course, do a lot more due diligence. Banks are also required to hold larger pools of cash at all times. So these are all changes that have been done to protect the economies from a similar situation.
Yeah, exactly. Something else also is the housing, where you know, properties can't be flipped as easily because of the fees that have been introduced within the system, where they are minimum fees. And so people can't just buy and sell and make a quick buck. So yeah, all of these situations are different. I think bringing it back to investments, markets, I mean, that's what we're here for. So let's bring it back to markets and investments. And where would you say that our listeners should look at investing today, given the situation?
I think if there is anything that our listener takes back from all our content, it should be this one point of identifying value companies that have intrinsic profitability, and investing in these and not getting perturbed by any short-term losses, short-term ups and downs, instead of investing in junk that might make them a quick buck overnight, but it doesn't last in the long run. Right, so treat investment as a marathon, not a sprint, and look for value companies to invest in. With these two, you can't really go wrong.
Yeah, I've got a third one to add there, actually, diversification. So even though you may love three companies, you can't put all your wealth in three companies. You've got to invest in different sectors, different markets. There's no one person that can predict what will happen and what will go which way. For that reason, you want to kind of buffer it up in a way that if something goes down by 20%, you've got the buffer of, like, this year, for example, energy, that's actually done quite well, right? So diversification is very, very important to make the ride a bit smoother, the path to making money a bit smoother, and your risk-adjusted numbers are then a little bit more attractive.
Perfect. Yeah. That was a perfect addition and a perfect way to end this episode. Hopefully it added to your understanding of where we are now, and it adds to you feeling optimistic about the future. And that's what we're here to do as fantastic females.
So with that, we bring this episode of our financial adventure to an end. Please follow us on all social media platforms at Fantastic Females.
None of the information provided is financial advice, and Fantastic Females is not a financial advisor.
The information provided is educational only. It is general in nature and does not take into account your personal circumstances.
Please use your own due diligence before making any financial or investment decisions.